Hello and welcome to episode 2 of Frame to Frame with me, Andy Williams.
I'm Sean Wilson.
And this week we're going to be talking to you about media films from 1976. So, films that depict different aspects of the media from 1976. Those two films are going to be, Sean,
Network and All the President's Men. And what a double bill that is.
I mean, it's a very intense double bill. They're not the most easygoing of films.
For what we were just saying was a very, very intense year of films, because that year you also had Taxi Driver, The Omen and Marathon Man all came out that same year. So I imagine audiences felt absolutely pummeled.
This is true. I mean, there was a Mel Brooks film out this year as well in Silent Movie. So, you know.
Yeah, just kind of balance it, yeah.
I mean, you've got the absurdity of Mel Brooks just to try and counterbalance. But so this week we're going to be focusing on Network and All the President's Men, which are absolute classic films of their own genres. And we thought we'd kick off with Network first, because I believe, Sean, you watched this a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, for the first time I'd had it on, you know, that classic scenario when you bought a film ages ago on DVD, if people do indeed still buy those. I'm assuming that there are some people that still do that.
I do.
Yeah. I'm kind of preaching to the choir here, aren't I? A little bit, which is fine. And it was still in the packaging. It was still in the cellophane, and I took it out and I thought, I haven't watched this, and I'm in lockdown, and I'm looking for things to occupy myself. What better way than to watch a so-called classic film I hadn't seen? And I was aware of it. I was aware that it had won multiple Oscars, including a posthumous one for Peter Finch. I think that makes him the only posthumous best actor recipient of an Oscar, along with Heath Ledger, if I'm not mistaken. I'm sure I read that online. So
absolutely correct. Yeah.
That's correct. Okay.
He's the only one to have won Best Actor, whereas Heath Ledger won it for Best Supporting.
Yeah, there we go. So if that question comes up in a pub quiz, both me and you would do very, very well.
I'm due to be writing another pub quiz, because obviously in lockdown that's pretty much all we can do is just get on various different streaming platforms with our nearest and dearest and do pub quizzes. So I'm due to be writing another round soon, so that may well be a question.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that your sadistically difficult question for people who haven't seen Network? So it's a good question.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. So wait and see.
Yeah, I mean, so I was aware of its reputation. I was aware of its standing as a commentary on media. I was aware who directed it, Sidney Lumet and Paddy Chayefsky wrote it, and the fact that the cast obviously also includes Robert Duvall, William Holden, Faye Dunaway. So, like, you know, who's who of like late 60s, early to mid 70s actors. Actually, oddly enough, this is, you know, apropos to nothing, but The Towering Inferno was on the other day, and that has Faye Dunaway in it. And I was like,
Doesn't it?
Wow, I was like, she was everywhere in the 1970s. She was literally everything.
She was.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. Wasn't she in Chinatown?
Yeah, Chinatown. Well? Yeah. Same year as Towering Inferno. Yeah. So it just, all those films are like Network, just basically reinforced what an extraordinary period that kind of new Hollywood era was, up from like the late 60s up to the, you know, early to mid 70s. And I hate to sort of sound like a droning film school student, but hey, I always sound like that anyway. It's true.
I mean, that era is so perfectly summed up in both the book and the film Easy Riders, Raging Bull.
Yeah,
don't know if you've ever read or seen that, but I thoroughly recommend it to anybody that's listening.
Is it Peter Siskind who wrote that, or am I?
I'm gonna bow to your knowledge on this.
Okay,
one.
Okay, I might be incorrect about that, but yeah, you're right. It's a brilliant book.
Brilliant book. And I've got, there's a documentary that's been made of the book as well, so I've got that, which, if you haven't seen it, Sean, I do thoroughly recommend.
Okay, I'll take that on board. But
we might do that another day. Documentaries based on early 70s movements.
Yeah. You thought we couldn't get more niche than media movies in 1976. You were wrong.
we'll keep trying. We'll try for it.
we'll burrow down into something even more niche. Yeah. So, I mean, I think Network kind of sums up the bravery and also I think the honesty of the films that were being made at this point. I think this is the kind of film that could only have been made at this point in Hollywood history, because it's interesting that a year after this film came out, the first Star Wars movie came out, and all of a sudden populist
blockbuster.
Yeah, exactly, and Jaws obviously as well. So I think this was probably Network was probably one of the outliers of that quite dark, gritty, uncompromising dramas that you got throughout the 1970s. Again, you think of things like Taxi Driver, you think of things like Klutz, movies that are just quite unblinking, that take a very uncompromising look at people and the structures in which they operate. I mean, the Taxi Driver obviously does that, the idea of like God's Lonely Man. You know, he's on this like hellish odyssey through New York, largely at nighttime. Loads of movies did this. And I, having never watched Network, but having been aware of Sidney Lumet's reputation as one of, you know, the great actors of all time, like 12 Angry Men and so on, even by those standards, I was really knocked out by it. I thought it's a movie that really lives up to its reputation. In fact, it's probably more relevant now than it was when it came out, I would venture to say. I know it's a bit of a cliche, but it's...
I mean, I can completely see what you're saying. So for those that haven't seen it, the narrative of Network is about a TV news anchor that almost goes through some sort of breakdown whilst on air, but because of the ratings that drives, the network then find different ways to try and exploit him and try and use his breakdown for their own profit. So the idea of the ultra capitalism and trying to really capitalize on this man's mental health is, when you consider this is a film from, we say, the 1976, the mid-70s, where the idea of mental health wasn't a discussed thing. It was just you had bad nerves or something along those lines. To have it circling back to his actual breakdown and people noticing that, but also noticing the spike that it's getting in the ratings, was quite fascinating. And again, it speaks to what you mentioned about it being relevant now, of the sort of things that happen within reality television, both in the Western world and obviously in Korea, Japan, and all those sorts of places where you see all sorts of strange clips on the internet.
I mean, when I was watching it, I was thinking of this really did anticipate the nonsense like Big Brother, in which what you're seeing is very often, as is often happened with Big Brother, you have exploitation of people within a limited environment being presented for mass entertainment, which is what happens in Network with Peter Finch's character, with Howard. Peter Finch is obviously an extraordinary actor, and his performance in this is heart-wrenching. Yeah, the fact that he is being exploited by the Robert Duvall and Faye Dunaway characters, who can see the success coming. But the brilliance of Paddy Chayefsky's script and Sidney Lumet's direction is there's a flip. There's a moment where, at the moment where he's being perceived as a joke by the audience, that's when the situation plays into their hands. However, when he sort of becomes almost like a messiah, a prophet who embodies the contradictions of the age in which he's living, the idea of conglomerates exploiting the little man, the hypocrisy of American society, all of a sudden he finds relevance and he's no longer a fool. He actually becomes, as I said, like a prophet-like figure. And all of a sudden they realise that potential in him, that exploitative potential, is slipping away from them and they don't like it. And so it catches that very fickle, ephemeral balance between greed and exploitation and power, and I think it walks that razor's edge. I think you're absolutely right when you use the phrase mental health. I mean, to be honest, I thought of it more of as a mental health movie than a media movie. I thought the mental health issue for me was the center of the whole storyline personally.
I agree with you, and with the performance of his former producer and his best friend Max in the film, played by William Holden, I think that really helps bring that aspect home, because everybody else is out to exploit him. But I mean, we're going to be discussing all aspects of the film, I think, at this point. So it's been out since 1976. We've also pre-warned you ahead of this podcast. So Max does eventually leave his post at the network because everybody else is looking to exploit Howard, and he just says, no, he's my best friend and I'm not going to do that. So he effectively sort of falls on his sword to get out of there, because he sees what people are trying to do, and he knows that he's got no way out. And other than that, it's leaving the job.
I mean, I suppose one should also look at the collateral damage in the movie. I mean, Beatrice Straight, who plays Max's wife, who really only gets one scene in the movie for about 5 minutes, and she got an Oscar, and it's got to be one of the best marital dysfunction meltdown scenes that's ever been put on camera. No wonder she got an Oscar for it. And it shows that the cruelty of what is going on at the network station is kind of rippling out into the private lives of the characters. But the way that it's shot is, I mean, as is the case with most Sidney Lumet films and most films of this period, it's not shot in an ostentatious, flashy way. It's filmed in a very just observant, crisp manner that I think allows the actors to really grapple with the material. Again, it almost felt kind of theatrical to me in a way. You've got a fairly limited number of characters interacting in a probably, you know, a relatively limited number of spaces, most of them all interior. And I did think there was...
It walked him into a play.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that you say that. I sort of echo what you mentioned about the direction, is that I thought it was very unfussy, and it was very subservient to both the actors and the script. It really allowed the script to shine through, because instead of, you know, sort of those Tarantino-esque touches with showing, look how good of a director I am, it sort of stepped back and just allowed you to be in the scene with the actors and the characters. I did want to raise a question to you, slightly left field.
I did want to raise a question about
how tasteful you thought this film was. It was released in 1976, like we've mentioned a few times. So that's only 2 years after Christine Chubbuck actually killed herself live on air as an anchorwoman. Do you feel that it sort of stepped on some toes? Do you feel it was distasteful in any way?
No, I don't. I think if it was distasteful, the film wouldn't work. I think it's a profoundly moral film, and I think Sidney Lumet was a profoundly moral filmmaker. He was never lacking for that. You think this is the man who made, like I said, 12 Angry Men. He made Serpico, you know, finished his career with Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, which is another fantastic film. I think that he recognizes that it's a tragedy. He and Paddy Chayefsky recognize that it is a tragic story. It's about one man being sent as a lamb to the slaughter. And there's that really chilling scene with, again, talk about actors that make an impact in a very short amount of time. There's that scene with Ned Beatty as the character of Arthur Jensen, who delivers this extraordinary monologue about the state of capitalist America and the role of the individual in capitalism. Again, of all the scenes in the movie, that is the kind of most showy-offy, like grandstanding moment, and yet it works because it articulates the theme of the film so well, and that's why I don't think the film is distasteful. I think it hits exactly the tone that it needs to, and the only character that you do sympathise with is Peter Finch. I mean, maybe to an extent William Holden's character, but I mean, Faye Dunaway and Robert Duvall's characters are both utterly loathsome, and I think they're meant to be. You're not meant to be on their side at all, and then when am I allowed to say what happens with William Holden and Faye Dunaway? Am I to assume that people have seen?
Yeah, like I said, it's a film from 1976.
I just want to be careful.
Embargoes are, I get that. But I mean, we've pre-warned people ahead of time. We thoroughly recommend that you watch these movies before we discuss them. And then if you've got any questions that you want us to try and tackle on the podcast, then just send them in to us either by Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter.
Yeah.
But sorry, yeah, go ahead and you carry on.
There's the scene where William Holden basically chucks Faye Dunaway's character, and he almost comes to his own moment of realization of like, what is my life? Like, you know, he basically says she's nothing without her job. And she is, she's careerist and she's scheming and she's really unpleasant, but
then she has that moment of realization.
Yeah.
As soon as he says that, that realization sets in for her. Whilst, and then she actually says, "Stay with me, then take me back."
Yeah.
He said, "No, this is over," and that being the penultimate scene of the film, I think really hit home. Especially as he just sort of walks out the door, he doesn't slam the door and he just lets it close on its own.
Yeah.
And it's those tiny little touches that I really, really liked.
And it's great because I think it finds human qualities in even the most repellent of characters. Because, I mean, Robert Duvall is not a pantomime villain, but he's an opportunist, and he sees an opportunity to boost ratings and he runs with it. But that's a character the character is chilling because you believe in it. You believe in his greed, and watching his subsequent downfall when Howard unwittingly turns the tables without knowing it and all of a sudden starts to become a figure of relevance rather than a figure of fun. Watching Robert Duvall's character like squirm and sort of come undone is very satisfying to watch. So I think it is a very humane film. I think that's probably why it's endured for so long, I'd say.
Okay, I thought I'd throw the idea out to you about the potential of it being so close to a real life incident that I believe being inspired by that real life incident. But, you know, I completely take on board what you're saying, and I actually, frankly, agree with you. So in terms of the film as a whole and its influence, I mean, we'll get back to the film in a bit more detail in a second. But one thing that really struck me on rewatching it now, I watched it probably about 10 odd years ago when I was studying media studies for the first time. And I didn't put two and two together about the influence that this had had over lots of different things, but especially Aaron Sorkin and The Newsroom. So Aaron Sorkin, generally speaking, is also a fan of a monologue, but I'm specifically going to point to The Newsroom because the first episode of The Newsroom actually has somebody asking the question, why is America the greatest country in the world? He's a newscaster and he turns around and his answer is perceived as a meltdown on air. That's your starting point. That's your inciting incident in that TV series. So putting two and two together of the influence that this had over that was just fascinating. How much do you think this has influenced genuine popular culture over the years intervening?
Oh, massively. I'd say that, again, it anticipated I think that there's quite a febrile appetite for things in pop culture. Now we like watching self destruction. That I think there is an appetite. There is kind of like a nihilistic, almost sadistic appetite for watching self destruction. I mean, why else would something like Big Brother thrive? The reason is because you put a bunch of fairly grotesque, maybe not altogether bright people in a room, and then you basically light the fuse and you watch what happens. It's not motivated by an altruistic social experiment. It's motivated because it's appealing to people's base instincts, and then you package it up and you sell it to a mass audience. And I think,
I mean, you can go even further than just Big Brother. You can look at things like the Jerry Springer Show.
Yeah,
you know, there's the amount of people that will go on these shows like Jeremy Kyle and just put their dirty laundry out there for the sake of ratings. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why, I know there's obviously other reasons, but why neither shows are on air anymore is because that realization has come from people of, oh, actually, this kind of isn't right for people to be doing this anymore.
It's not moral. I mean, I suppose the other thing that Network did brilliantly as well was it shows the invasive nature of news, which we've definitely got now in the era of 24-hour rolling news. The idea that what Network picks out brilliantly is the way that the broadcast invades the lives of Americans and gets under their skin and gets into the culture. And there's that. Funnily enough, in the midst of the lockdown, we're having the NHS clap every Thursday, and there is a scene in Network, which it very eerily kind of mirrors that, but for a much more kind of ironic perverse effect. I mean, it's not healthcare that's being clapped. It's got a much more kind of like tragic, ironic like air to it. But
no, it's the catchphrase of the film. Ultimately, yeah. It's the "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore."
Yeah,
and I mean, I hadn't seen the mirroring until you've mentioned it, but now you say it, it's strange and it's eerie, yeah. The fact that you've mentioned it in that context.
And isn't it remarkable that a film from 1976 shows how media can condition people? That's basically what it is. Media conditions people based on what they watch. And to an extent that is happening, or that's happening now. I mean, it's no news to say that's happening now. In this day and age, more so than it was in 1976. Yeah,
we're all ultimately tied to the media nowadays. We're scrolling through social media, or we're watching something on TV. In the film, they reference television quite a lot as being the primary sort of issue to do with this. So it is quite interesting watching it through a 21st century lens, where you and I are both sat on laptops right now, which has access to almost anything. And, you know, you go downstairs and you've got a games console, or you've got, there's always something on your person. I'm wearing a smart watch.
Yeah.
So you're always connected to some form of media.
Yeah.
And that's just getting more and more. And that has got more and more since the film has come out. And that's probably why it's endured as long as it has, because instead of the television sort of dating it somewhat, it's actually, it predicted what was going to happen in a way that I think you can only really look at somebody like George Orwell for the future nihilism in terms of predictions. So,
I mean, the whole thing about George Orwell as well, which is you control the masses based on what information you dole out at any one time. And they realize that by fashioning a narrative around Howard's breakdown, that will draw the punters in. It will draw them in, and there's that very skillful manipulation. But the whole idea of a meltdown playing out in front of a mass audience, I mean, just look at how a certain world leader has been behaving lately, and the amount of relish that people are. I probably don't need to point out who that is, but
I was wondering how long it'd take you to swing around to that.
Yeah, but it's true. Like Network anticipated it. I mean, there are people who support him. But there are people like me who just take sort of morbid amusement in watching someone who has, you know, no social faculties whatsoever, just completely imploding. I mean, in this instance, I'd say that's not tragic, whereas in Network, it is tragic. But
oh, Sean, yeah. I knew you were going to get political.
Yeah. But it's a deeply it is a very, very political film. I mean, the film doesn't hide that. It's a question of how much you buy into it, really. But
this is true. And I think politics plays even more of a part in into the next film that we're going to cover, in All the President's Men. But just before we leave Network, have you got anything that you wanted to specifically shout out about the film?
It's really interesting. I'm not... I will say that I thought William Holden was really, really, really great and really terrific. Just, I mean, from, you know, they think of things like the Wild Bunch and things like that. He's a really, really phenomenal actor. And I think, I don't know whether he ever got the credit that he deserved in Network, but he definitely deserved it. He's brilliant in it.
Yes, he really is. Apologies for the slight beeping over the back of you then. Some technical issues happening at my end, so apologies about that. But yeah, I completely agree with you. He sort of carries the emotional heart of the film, as we mentioned. He's the one that grounds how abhorrent what's happening to Howard is, and he's the one that sees it and reacts to it in the only way that he really can. So, you know, it's a phenomenal film, and the reason it's endured is because it is as good as people say it is.
Indeed.
So that is Network. Are you just taking a swig of your slightly crafty beer there, Sean?
Yes, I have. should we point out to people this is actually becoming a theme? So it's beer and podcasting at the same time. So
yes, and if you would like to see which beers we're both drinking, you'll be able to see that on our Instagram page. We'll be uploading images of our beers every single week. I'm trying to go for a theme to the beers and linking it into the film somehow.
Yeah.
This week I've done particularly well. I'm not going to reveal the theme here. I'll do that on Instagram. But yeah, I'm quite pleased with myself on this one.
I've gone to Germany, which is the home of the second best beer in the world. Belgium is number one, but I'm not there at the moment.
Well, yeah, I can't help with that. Unfortunately, no flights. So.
Yeah, stay with me, I'll teach you.
I would argue Ireland, but there we go. Yeah. You know me, good pint of Guinness.
Yeah.
But, right, so from Network to All the President's Men. So for those that don't know the story of All the President's Men, I hope that you do. I hope that you've watched it ahead of listening to this podcast. But if you don't, it tells the story, the true story of Woodward and Bernstein, the two journalists that investigated and uncovered the Watergate scandal for the Washington Post. I think that these the two men in real life are actually just phenomenal journalists. That goes without saying. And the sort of the bit between the teeth that they get for this story and run with it is just absolutely phenomenal. But the interesting fact about All the President's Men is that they still show the film in journalism school to show exactly how it is that that these people had the amount that they had to do in order to get a story of this size. So, Sean, tell us a little bit about your thoughts on All the President's Men.
Well, I think it's quite simply the best film about journalism ever made. I think you can't. I mean, for both of us, we work in a publishing office, and I think you'd agree with me that the film's evocation of being in that environment, of being in a big open plan media office, is spot on. It's the way that the direction by Alan J. Pakula works hand in hand with the ever-present sound design, like what was back then the classroom of typewriters, will now be obviously replaced with the hammering of keys on Macs and everything, but the principle still stands. But just the hubbub of activity is so atmospherically, the film is so well brought across, it feels so authentic, and that extends down into the casting as well. And what you've got in the form of I think the real life Woodward and Bernstein said, well, clearly we're not as good looking in real life as Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman, but that doesn't matter because they both bring a kind of like weathered sort of lived in sensibility. Like they both kind of look like they haven't changed out of their respective shirts for like the best part of a week. They look like they've been up against deadlines, and there is a real kind of physicality that you would expect from these actors, particularly from Hoffman.
I was about to mention that specifically, that I think it's to do a lot with the costumes.
Yeah.
They look just so, like I say, lived in, and just like they could do with a good old wash. So I think a lot does point back to that, and the aesthetic of the film, I think, is part of the reason that it looks the way that it does. And you've got to think about the long shots of the office that they provide, the fact that they give you such wide angles and show exactly what's going on, and then we'll go and sort of zoom in exactly to Woodward or Bernstein whilst they're usually on the phone trying to uncover something. And I think just the direction in that sense is what keeps this office living.
Yeah, and I think one for me, like, you have to shout out to Jason Robards as Ben Bradley, who is brilliant. I think that what he does is he gets the air of casual authority of the editor who's got his own office, who has to be basically summoned to go and talk to the grunts, basically, that are supplying him copy. And I think anyone who's ever stared down an editor before, I know I have, there's that moment of panic where you've written something and you know that they're checking it over, and he gets that quietly intimidating. You know, Jason Robards not exactly the most physically imposing actor, but just the way those scenes when he comes out and he checks over their notes about how their investigation into the Watergate scandal is going, and he just sort of scores like red lines through everything, going, you know, I paraphrase like crap, get rid of that, you know, that angle isn't right, and then just walks off again, is the brutality of that is really, really well done. And Jason Robards got an Oscar for this, and he definitely deserved it. I think it's a really terrific performance.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. I think the scene that he has where he sort of he mentioned some of the mistakes he's made of the past, and somebody looked at him and said, "This is your fault, Bradley." And I think that scene alone, his performance in that is worthy of an Oscar, not to mention the physicality and the intimidation factor that you've mentioned about when you hand copy to him. I think the overall investigation that Woodward and Bernstein go on, and the I'm going to sound like a trailer now, but the journey they go on as, you know, initially not wanting to work together, to being sort of bottom of the rung in the Washington Post, to then uncovering the story that they uncover. I think in terms of how the film deals with that, it doesn't really glorify them. I didn't feel that it sort of, I mean, it obviously celebrated them and their achievements, but it didn't try and sort of ram down your throat. Look at how good they're being at their jobs, and it's just quietly getting on with it and doing what needed to be done. I think that's what really needs celebrating from the film.
Yeah, I mean, there's no sermonizing. There's absolutely no sermonizing it. And I think, again, like Network, the movie is a product of its time. The movie is a product of an era in Hollywood that wasn't necessarily sensationalist or melodramatic, that was just very pragmatic, where, as we said with Network, the direction, I loved your word, the direction is very unfussy. It's very clean. And it favours, I mean, we haven't mentioned the script by William Goldman. This is a movie that is driven primarily by its script and by its actors. And there is a lot of dialogue to deliver, obviously adapted from...
All of it factually accurate and checked multiple times just to confirm that it is, in fact, factually accurate.
Yeah.
Like, there was no ad-libbing, no anything other than this has to be correct. We have to do this the right way.
And you mean you can see the sheer level of nuance in the writing. You can quite clearly see the influence on what is a later film and one of my personal favourite films, which is David Fincher's Zodiac, which I think is is a masterpiece. And you can quite clearly
see... down a note to bring this up later on, of the influence that this had on Zodiac.
Oh, okay. I won't go any further with that thought then. I'll hold that.
we've just done it now. The cat's out the bag now, sure.
Okay, yeah, fair.
In terms of investigating something that people are telling you not to do, and you're just sort of being pulled in seven different directions and saying, no, go this way, go that way. To have, especially in All the President's Men, to have that one person driving you back to what seems to be the bigger story, I think that really helped both Woodward and Bernstein in real life and in the film. Because you had the character of Deep Throat that would then just bring them back and say, no, actually, look at the bigger picture. Why don't you follow the money? And do you know what I mean? Those sorts of things. Whereas in, I guess, with Zodiac, because it is an unsolved case, there always had to be multiple potential options as to who the killer would have been. Whereas this didn't have that.
That's interesting, yeah. Yeah, because obviously in All the President's Men, the film is governed by a narrative that was obviously complete by the time the film came out. The film obviously adapted a complete narrative, which was the Watergate investigation. Yeah, whereas you're right, whereas the reason why Zodiac is so creepy is because there was no objective conclusion. There was speculation, and very, very engrossing, believable speculation, but it was only speculation at the end of that, which is why that film is so eerie. And that film also contrasts with All the President's Men for that reason. Although I'd say it owes a huge debt to All the President's Men, it is also very different from it. And I think that objectivity, I'd say, is the key word of all the Presence Men. The final shot of the movie is just a very, very quiet, if I remember rightly, the camera just sort of tracks backwards through the office very, very quietly, and that their story becomes one of, you know, many other stories that's going on in that office. Mm-hmm. It just so happens that story is one of the defining ones of its day. But they are professionals, they're workers. And I think it's interesting. I think had the film maybe come out 10 years later, I think what you would have got would have been probably a far more melodramatic, like corny resolution with a big swell of music at the end. Like with the greatest respect to him, the kind of thing that you might expect Ron Howard to have done.
I know exactly the type of film that you mean.
You know what I mean?
I do. I think the final shot of the movie scene is we're discussing it. I actually had to sort of put down what I was holding at that point, which was a cold water, if I'm being honest with you. I was going to make it sound cooler than it was, but it wasn't. I had to put that down and comment exactly how good that shot is, because you've got the mirror image of the Nixon inauguration. His second inauguration, and then you've got Woodward and Bernstein either side of a pillar, and it's just sort of slowly pulling out. And that shot was the fact that they'd mirrored them and contained them within almost contained within the Nixon administration, but they are then looking to expand that pillar to drive a wedge between Richard Nixon and the presidency, which, as we know, ultimately happens. I thought that final shot just almost said everything. You didn't need to have the right at the end. After that, you have the typewriters fiercely typing and giving us headlines as to what happened afterwards and updating us on how the story eventually finished. I didn't feel that you needed that given the final shot of the film.
Yeah, it's I do love films from this period in that they allow us to reach our own emotional conclusion. They give us the facts, but they don't try and impose any kind of aggressive emotional manipulation of the situation, which is very good. I mean, I think, funny enough, I mentioned The Towering Inferno earlier in reference to Faye Dunaway in Network. And I as I've said, that All the President's Men is a salute to professionalism. I think, you know, The Towering Inferno is another movie like that in which Paul Newman and Steve McQueen, you know, get as many people out of the burning building as possible, and then Steve McQueen just gets back in the fire truck at the end and just goes off, presumably on to the next job. It's like, yeah, no melodramatics, no heroics, got no time for that. And I kind of think All the President's Men owes a lot to that. I mean, weirdly, it's almost kind of the inverse of Network, because Network is very much not about professionalism at all. It's not about integrity, it's about the absence of that. So maybe these two films that we're talking about offer a more interesting contrast than we first thought.
Well, yeah, this is true, but I mean they're thematically linked, but so that's the reason that we chose the two of them for this week. But I can completely see what you're saying. They, one offers the view of working hard and almost the American dream. This is, if you work hard, you will be able to achieve everything that you were looking to achieve. Whereas Network, on the other hand, offers the more toxic look at that. If you work too hard, look at the effects that you can have.
And I suppose, I mean, one could also say that Network, I mean, Network being a fictional story and obviously All the President's Men being true, but Network being fictional, one could say that's a fictional response to the Nixonian administration and all the cynicism that engendered, all the anger and the disillusionment. You know, whereas All the President's Men is interested in just the facts around Watergate, maybe Network is a response to the atmosphere of the time, perhaps.
Yeah, potentially. It's specifically said in Network that people are angry and people want somebody to reflect their anger. And I couldn't help but think that was the screenwriter almost venting out his own anger. You know, you look at things like Fight Club for that. I don't know if you ever saw the first episode of Mr. Robot.
No.
Which is on Amazon. That, like, the anger in those things, in those texts, that really comes through. And that's what came through when that line was said in Network for me, was that the screenwriter saying, I am angry, this is how I feel, and this is why I think that. Almost presenting us with his thesis on why. But that's where I think both films are very interesting, because All the President's Men is far more optimistic.
Yeah.
In a sort of twisted way. But as you said, it's a fascinating year for film, for 1976. The fact that you had these two, you know, like you said, closely linked in some ways, but polar opposites in others. So it's a fascinating year for film. And we will be looking next week. Once again, we won't be necessarily revealing the films that we're going to be discussing here. But I'm sure you'll be able to guess at least one of them ahead of next week's shows. We're going to be doing rock music documentaries or rock docs for next week. So it gives us a chance to explore some of the musical tastes that Sean and I wouldn't necessarily say share, but hey, we've been to a couple of gigs together. So, you know, I guess there's some element of sharing there. Yes. So what are you looking forward to most out of next week's show?
Well, it's going to have to be the Lonely Island movie, Pop Star, Never Stop, Never Stopping. I've got that title right, haven't I? It's deliberately.
You haven't, but you've also revealed the title of one of the films that we're going to be discussing.
Okay, so. Yeah. I have had half a beer, so we won't reveal the other one, and people can probably guess what that is. Yeah, I like Lonely Islands. I never watched this film when it came out. I do love a rockumentary, mockumentary, whatever you want to call them.
Mock rock doc.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like the almost like
a rom-com.
Yeah, rom-com. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I will engage with this.
Excellent.
I'm looking forward. Cool.
Well, that's good.
And apologies for the spoilers.
What you like? People will learn that. That's just what you're like.
Yeah, yeah. I need a T-shirt with spoiler on it.
Well, this is why we now get to discuss films that have been out for a decent amount of time that we can do in all its glory, because in the previous incarnation of our podcast in life, when we reviewed new films, very often Sean would have seen a film that I hadn't. So I was sat there thinking, oh, yeah, this film sounds great. This film sounds great. Oh, wait, no, that's exactly what happens in the film, so I'm not going to watch it anymore. Thank you very much, Sean.
Yeah, yeah, and it's also put me in a difficult position, because I wasn't sure how much I was allowed to say, and I thought, oh, screw it, I'm just going to say what I want. yeah, because otherwise I'd be there all evening. We should also reinforce for people who might be tuning in for the first time to this episode is that we've got our weird tendency of starting to agree with each other on a broad canvas. And then when we get into the exact details, we find bits that we don't actually agree on, which is a very peculiar process.
It is, but broadly speaking, over the last two episodes of the four films that we've discussed, we've agreed on pretty much everything.
Yeah, but let's not go any further than that, because it will happen.
And I promise there will not be a William Goldman film next week. That's a promise.
Not,
you know, last week we had Princess Bride. This week we had All the President's Men. So next week...
Can we not do The Ghost in the Darkness? Have you ever seen that?
It doesn't fit the theme, unfortunately.
No, it doesn't. That's a William Goldman movie that hardly anyone's seen either. So, yeah.
Maybe another week.
Yeah.
Maybe another week. But so that is pretty much it for this second episode of Frame to Frame. Follow us on Instagram. This is going to be a mouthful for me, so give me a second. We're on Instagram at frame_2_frame250. Or we're on Twitter, which is much easier, at frame2frame2. So if you want to give us a follow there, that will be posting images, looking for engagement, taking questions. And if there's anything you want us to cover in the podcast in coming episodes, then please just let us know. Until next week, this has been Media Films of 1976. I'm Andy Williams.
I'm Sean Wilson.
Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll speak to you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.